Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Said one morning soon, said one morning soon, one morning soon, heard the angels singing.
How's everybody doing tonight? So about tonight's music by Jeff Clanton. Y'all like Jeff? Jeff Clanton is a singer-songwriter from Conway, Arkansas. He usually plays the role of sideman with many artists in the area, but tonight he played solo just for us. He's got CDs for sale after the show tonight. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on the road and on location at the incredible Faulkner County Library in beautiful Conway, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is made possible in part by the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. A former house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi, Mark wrote our theme music, plays for us live for our regular shows, and came on the road with us for this show tonight. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? When we go on the road, we bring a few pieces of our regular set, which are these amazing screen doors, one on this side and one on that side, by the artist B.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. More can be seen at grapevineart.com. We also feature an artist from the area, so tonight's featured artist is Conway painter Sheila Parsons, and the piece that we're featuring is this piece behind me here, which is entitled Hilltop Grocery and is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Sheila at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, all of our storytellers are from Faulkner County, Arkansas, and they each find themselves in a situation where they must change. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Leanne Warriner's change happens despite her intentions, and we'll end the night with Debbie Fowler and a change of plans that is forced upon her. But let's start the night with Wyatt Jones as he has a change of heart in A Ponytail.
We camped on the high plains in an old burned-out homestead. The cattle were bedded down for the night. It was clear and cool with a bright moon. We huddled around the fire, laughing, talking, when a young woman stepped out of the shadow and into the light. The sight of her took us by surprise. As she stopped and slowly gazed at us, slowly a puzzled look crossed over her face, and she stepped back into the darkness. We ran to where she stood and hollered, "Ma'am?" We thought she was a traveler who had gotten lost, but she never answered. We searched on until the morning and didn't find so much as a track or even a bent blade of grass. Nothing. It was as if she had never been there, or if she had, she'd simply vanished. He snapped a gnarled finger. Lee Drury was what many called a real cowboy. Now in his 80s, sitting on his porch in Oklahoma, my great uncle spun tales of the old West to the delight of his impressionable young nephew. Belle Starr wasn't a bad woman, like some folks claim. She was our neighbor, and she gave me my first pony when I was no bigger than you. He sipped his coffee. What he didn't say or didn't know was that his benefactor had been jailed in Fort Smith for horse rustling. Or perhaps he did know and simply chose not to look too close at the gift pony. I stood by the gate feeding a dried corn stalk to our mare Patsy. At age 5, I'd never ridden a horse, but now I got an idea. I climbed the fence using the rails as a ladder and leapt onto her back while my cousin ran ahead of us, dangling the stalk ahead of her. Most horses frighten easily. Any unexpected sound, odor, or movement will spook them. But even though Patsy was a quarter horse, she was a large, lazy, dreamy mare, more prone to sniffing flowers and chasing butterflies than racing. She sallied back and forth like a bored fashion model strolling the runway. I was thrilled, but my mama, on the other hand, was not quite so amused. My great-grandfather had come north on a cattle drive from Texas to South Central Indian Territory. He was in his 40s when he courted and married a 14-year-old girl, and in return, he claimed as a dowry a parcel of land called Seatick Flat. Despite its alluring name, the settlement failed to prosper. Today, it's an abandoned cemetery, its most frequent visitors being the occasional grave robber, though perhaps it's not a total failure, as I'm told the Seaticks are still doing quite well. In the mid-50s, we moved to Conway in the Arkansas River Valley. In many ways, this part of Arkansas resembled Oklahoma. Surveyors in the 1819 described the land around Conway as a 2,200-acre prairie on the northern border of the Ouachita Mountains. Minus the elk and buffalo, the fields surrounding the town had changed little in the 150 years since. The tan sedge grass still swayed like ripe wheat in the wind. It was a sort of chigger heaven. Here my uncle ran a small herd of Mexican ponies, mostly mixed breed Shetlands. It's said that death rides a pale horse, which is a wise choice over feral ponies. To mount those tiny demons was to do so at one's own peril. And though some people prefer to refer to the term horse sense as a synonym for common sense, I felt at the time that the term as applied to this group was an oxymoron with a strong emphasis on the moron aspect. Daddy bought a half Shetland, half Welsh pony called Lightning for $25. And I used my sister's peroxide to bleach spots on his rump in a vain attempt to enter him in the county fair as an Appaloosa. But given his overall shape, the ruse was hopeless. He was a Frankensteed of sorts, shaggy brown with a black mane and tail. He had an overly large head and a big belly and short legs. He was heftier than the others, and being the largest pygmy in the pack had given him a superiority complex. I felt lucky that he wasn't carnivorous. For beyond sleeping and tormenting small children, his one joy was eating. His favorite treat was a Fritos. And when thirsty, he held a garden hose in his mouth and drank until swollen like a toad. Then he would lie snoozing in the shade of the mimosa. I was told that an ornery, spirited animal was better than a docile one. A sharp knife does not dull as quickly. I was assured that he would mellow with age. He did not. He would never cross a stream unless it was bridged or was near enough to jump. I learned this the hard way as he landed high and dry and I came up wet. One dared not turn one's back on him, or he would bite you. One dared not walk behind him, or he would kick you. If I stood beside him, he would stomp on my foot. When I called him, he ran away. The only manner to deal with him was subterfuge. To saddle him, I hid the bridle in his feed bucket, and I would slowly approach him, whistling cheerfully. And then I would grab the halter and quietly slip the bit in his mouth and he and I and my dog Coco would go roving along the old stagecoach road in the hills south of town. But as I grew older, living a cowboy's life seemed about as realistic as being a pirate. Lee was dead now, as much a ghostly memory to me as the spectral woman of the range had been to him. I sat atop the barn with binoculars watching 007 dispatching thugs on a distant drive-in screen, and now the only horse my playmates wanted was a Mustang convertible. I remember my last ride with Lightning over the tumble-down fences through what remained of the old prairie. We stopped at Sturgis Ridge, and I watched him graze as I sat under a pine, sharing a bologna sandwich with my dog. There was a low rumble rising out of the east, where heavy equipment was laying pavement for the new interstate. Later, we walked home as the setting sun bled into the western sky. An invisible jet traced a white line northward. As I stripped Lightning and curried him, he turned and looked at me. Surprisingly, he didn't bite me. He simply stared at me for a long time, and I saw something in his eyes that I'd never noticed before. A humble warmth and intelligence that until that moment I had been too proud, cold, and dense to see. A week later, I came home from school and found that Pop had sold him. Years passed, an urban blob swallowed the land. As our old barn fell into ruin, the city doubled and then tripled in size. Subdivisions crowded the base of Sturgis Ridge, capping it off with a string of nouveau riche McMansions. One day, I met a former neighbor who did remodeling work, and he said he'd seen Lightning grazing in a pasture on the estate of two local retired school teachers, sisters who ran a summer camp for children. They bought Lightning as a pet for the kids, but the first time that they tried, he ran under low-hanging tree branches and through briar thickets, throwing the kitties willy-nilly. Soon they gave up, and he began haunting a nearby long-neglected apple orchard, and he grew fat, glutting himself on the fallen fruit. My friend last saw him there, sleeping in the shade, and sometimes I wonder if he ever dreamed of me, as I still do of him, or if he was still as contrary as he seemed to be then. If he were here today, I suppose he might say, nay. At any rate, it was the end of the trail, for the pony too wild to be ridden, and the make-believe cowboy who became too tame to ride.
Wyatt Jones has co-authored two books, Hiking Arkansas and Arkansas Curiosities. He and his wife live in Conway with two dogs and two cats. They have considered getting a horse, but are too unstable themselves. Next, Leanne Warner has big plans, but reality changes all of that in Heavy Harvest, Heavy Heart.
What are you writing about this week, Mom? I asked during dinner. Well, I was thinking of writing about the fruit trees in the backyard, maybe sharing some pear and plum recipes. What do you think? Well, the trees were laden with fruit, so much so that Dad and I had spent the morning using old pieces of wood to hold up the heavy limbs. As we carefully placed the crutch-like supports, Dad had joked, "Huge crop this year. You better get to eating, kiddo." "I will," I laughed. The little wheels in my head began to turn. When Mom wrote an article, there was usually a picture of a cook or the recipe she was featuring. If she was writing about the trees in our backyard, I bet she would use me in the picture. "Yes, ma'am, I think that would be a great idea," I said. Then I quickly volunteered to help her wash the dishes so she could start to work finding recipes and such, a chore I usually hated because it always seemed to make my nose itch. I did with joy. It was the summer of 1970, and Mom had started working two jobs. The first was for money and the second was for fun. Her money job was at the bank downtown, NBC. Her fun job was writing a cooking column for the local newspaper, the Pine Bluff Commercial. The day the paper called and asked her to consider writing the weekly feature, she bought a used IBM Selectric from the bank and a typing stand and placed them both in the hallway right outside my bedroom door. The typewriter was avocado green and she could type so fast it sounded like the return chime was playing a song. When Mom worked, she would close all the doors in the hallway and it became her office. She had a funny habit of speaking out loud while she worked and her voice would echo. Yes, a parquet floored, 4.5 feet wide by 20 feet long office. It was loud and narrow and the only way to get to my room, and she loved it. As I washed the dishes, I kept thinking, wow, an article about the trees in our backyard with a picture of me right beside it. I had a hard time getting to sleep that night because I couldn't wait to get to school and tell my friends. The next morning, I was dressed and ready in record time, but it seemed we were stopped by every red light on that short 10-minute drive to Trinity Episcopal Day School. Mom's otherwise speedy yellow Cadet L couldn't go fast enough. I can remember sitting on the edge of my seat, leaning slightly forward as if that would make us go faster. Finally, we pulled up in front of the school, and I launched like a rocket out of the car, shouting over my shoulder, "Have a good day, Mom," as I ran to my classroom. Mrs. Dunn, my third grade teacher, greeted me at the door. "Slow down! You know better than to run in this classroom." "Yes, ma'am," I said, trying to catch my breath. "Guess what, Mrs. Dunn? Mom's writing an article about the fruit trees in our backyard, and I'm going to get my picture in the paper." "How exciting," she said. "It will be such fun to share it with the class, and maybe you can even bring some fruit." By the end of the day, I had told everyone at school about my big news. I woke up that Saturday morning to the sound of people talking in the backyard outside my bedroom window. That wasn't so unusual. Dad kept his flat-bottom boat back there, and on lots of Saturday mornings, there were neighbor men hanging out, visiting, while Dad cleaned his morning catch. Taking a quick peek through my curtains, I saw a man with a long ponytail with a camera around his neck and another man holding a tall silver ladder. They were here. Quickly, I got dressed in a pair of nice shorts and the red smock top my mama had made, the one with hoot owls and big patch pockets at my hips and butterfly sleeves. I pulled my hair into a neat ponytail and tied on a red yarn ribbon, slipped on my PF flyers, and dashed outside. My mom was walking around the yard looking for the best angle to show the trees and the huge fruit. "Hey, Leanne," came a voice from behind me. I jumped. It was my neighbor, Ricky. He had just gotten over the chicken pox and still had fresh pink polka dot patches all over him. Probably heard about the article and was trying to get in the picture, I thought to myself. "Hey, Ricky," I said suspiciously, "what are you doing here?" I kicked a pebble and stared at him hard, trying to signal that he was not welcome. Then he spoke. "Your mom invited me over to be in some picture for the paper." My mouth fell open and I slowly turned to look at my mom. She was busy directing everyone and leaning the tall ladder against the tree, not even watching out for the crutches. "Hey, Monkey, about time you woke up. You almost missed all the excitement." Monkey. I was called Monkey because I loved climbing trees, not Ricky. As usual, Mom looked like she just stepped out of the Sears summer catalog. She had on cigarette pants that zipped up the side and stopped just short of her knees, and a flowered shirt tied at her waist. The blue stretchy headband in her blonde hair matched her shirt, and she was barefooted. I bet she didn't want the dew to run her shoes. "Why is Ricky here?" I asked in a loud whisper. "We're going to take a picture of Ricky up on that ladder, picking pears to use in the article," she said, smiling. She was in her element. "Why?" I pleaded, my voice cracking. "Why not me?" I pretended to straighten my smock top so no one would see my tears. "Sweetie, I can't use you. You're my daughter, and it's just better if I use a neighbor instead." "Now, go on in and wash your face," she said, patting me on the head and giving me a little push on the back. With my 8-year-old world crumbling down around me, I ran inside, the screen door banging shut behind me, and dashed straight to my room. I flung myself on the bed and hugged my pillow and Mr. Pinky, my huge stuffed pink dog. How could she? What will I tell everyone at school? And why Ricky? He was only one grade older than me, but he thought he was so cool. He had a really neat treehouse in his backyard, but he wouldn't let me play in it. He bounced between I was too young or that I was a girl and it was a boys' club. Stupid boys. Besides that, they weren't even being careful with the fragile limbs that Dad and I had spent so much time trying to protect. I don't know how long I lay there, but eventually I got up and wandered down the hall into the kitchen. Mom was in their bedroom on the phone. Dad was in the adjoining den, sitting on his end of the couch, pulling on his cowboy boots. He had changed out of his powder blue coveralls with a magnetic belt buckle and into his usual Saturday uniform of carpenter jeans, western plaid shirt with two front pockets, and a leather belt with his name across the back. "Hey, kitten, tough morning?" "Yes, sir," I said, trying not to cry again. I opened the fridge and just stared. I missed breakfast, and so I was hungry, but nothing looked good. "I'm about to start work," Mom called as she closed the door to her hallway office. Dad looked at me and smiled. "Well, looks like it's you and me, kiddo. How about a barbecue?" "Sure," I said. Dad opened the door to the hallway. "Hun, we're going to go grab a sandwich. You want anything?" "No, I'm fine. I'll be busy for a while. I'll just have a pimento cheese and a Dr. Pepper later." As we headed towards the back door, I heard my mom say over the sound of the Selectric, "The trees are laden with fruit." If the trees are so laden with fruit, I thought to myself, then why am I so hungry?
Leanne Roland Warner was born and raised in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and now calls Conway home. She is a wife, mother, massage therapist, amateur conchologist, and dreamer trying to preserve it all on paper. In our final story of the night, let's go out on the water with Debbie Fowler as fate creates her change in We Should Have Seen It Coming.
A new fishing boat, well, new to us anyway. The old boat had died a slow death when finally the plug was pulled due to the diagnosis of terminal hole-in-bottomitis. One too many rocks in the generator-lowered White River had ended a long, fruitful life, and a replacement boat of different style and dimensions was fitted out for the maiden voyage. The initial trip with my husband's friend had yielded the first necessary alteration. Something, blah, blah, about the motor's position in the water. Don't ask me, I'm not nautical at all. I don't know port from a porthole. So that fix was carefully and mathematically applied by my proficient husband and his equally skilled friend. 2 days later, I was excited about taking the newly modified boat out on the White River with a side trip to the mouth of the Buffalo River to a spot that is very meaningful to my husband Wayne and I. He took me there on our second date, a mere 3.5 years ago. It was quite a romantic visit that day, much as the ensuing relationship has been, but that's a story for another day. So we backed the boat trailer down the ramp, stopping just so to unhitch and launch the boat. Wayne, wearing old tennis shoes that would have been more suited as impromptu skates on a frozen lake, lost his footing and slipped completely into the frigid Trout River for an accidental dip. He was fine, if chilled and embarrassed, but maybe we should have seen the portent of the slip and fall. He launched the boat and gave me the signal to pull vehicle and trailer up into the parking lot. "Aye, aye, skipper." But all of a sudden, he was up there with me, shouting for me to get back in the SUV. He'd left the plug out of the boat, and it was taking on water. We speedily backed down, rescued the boat, and drained it before employing the plug. Wayne gave the motor a turn before launching again and got silence for his effort. Ah, the battery wires had not been reconnected. Maybe we should have allowed just a wee bit of suspicion at this point. Upon relaunch, Wayne neglected to disconnect the winched cable that held the boat firm to the trailer. By this time, a group of others who had been milling around the area apparently felt the need to helpfully intervene. Possibly believing this to be our very first rodeo, and who could blame them if they'd witnessed Wayne's fall and then the sinking boat? Wayne figured out the cable problem and remedied it before outside help would have been just plain embarrassing for a man who had fished and boated that river for decades. So, boat plugged and launched, my job was to park the vehicle and trailer, which I handled quite proficiently, thank you, and proceeded to lock up our personal belongings with a supposed spare key in my hand. Only it wasn't a spare key to that car anyway. Noticing a back window slightly down, I went to unlock the door to raise the window, whereupon I discovered the spare key's refusal to magically morph from a Jeep key to a Ford key. I waved to Wayne, who pulled the boat up on shore and came to help. Since he had left his own keys and wallet safely in the car, we had to improvise. A tree branch was fashioned into a primitive Slim Jim to manipulate the automatic door lock from the slightly open window, and we were back in business. But by now, we really should have been prepared for more. Wayne turned to walk back down to the boat. I heard him say, "Oh no," just before he launched his own self toward the river. Yep, you can guess that the boat had loosened itself in the river's current and had begun our boat ride down the river, sans passengers. Flinging off shirt and glasses, Wayne dove in, sort of like they used to do on Baywatch. Now, for those who don't know, the White River is no swimming hole. Nobody, except possibly polar bears or penguins, would visit this trout mecca for the purpose of recreational bathing any more than you would the Arctic Sea or the Moon Sea of Tranquility. A 20-yard Australian crawl sprint reclaimed the boat. Wayne lobbed his blueing arms over the side, and after a minute or two to gather his breath, he's in good shape, but not for a spot on the Olympic team. He hoisted his right leg to the inside to laboriously reboard the errant vessel, only to be immediately advised by three fishermen in an approaching boat that they had headed over to rescue the boat themselves. This would have been a much saner and way more temperate solution. This still wouldn't be the last misstep. One unintentionally wet boat pilot and his dry, so far, bride finally set out to enjoy a boat ride meant to recreate a romantic bygone day down the White River from Buffalo City to just beyond the spot where it meets the beautiful Buffalo River. There is an archaic but very scenic bridge support built from stacked rocks, a place Wayne had taken me on our second date. Recently, we have become bridge hunters and decided we wanted a photo of this handsome structure, which had, unbeknownst to an acquainting couple, become the very first bridge in our collection. Oh. All went well until we approached the shallow rapids passageway, and Wayne strategically chose the spot that appeared to be the deepest and easiest traversed. A few yards out from my position in a boat seat in the front of the boat, I saw the hazard and gave an alert, but not nearly soon enough. We high-centered on a sneaky boat-grabbing boulder, cleverly camouflaged by the rushing water. Momentum pulled my unfastened seat to the left, and impossibly, I watched the river rapids rise up to meet me as I flipped over on all fours to plunge torso first into the glacial gush. Gifted with fairly good reflexes, I rebounded to my feet, gasping while retrieving the ability to breathe. Wayne had exited the boat and was holding on to steady it with his right hand while reaching out his left to save me from being swept away. Profuse and sincere apologies were the soundtrack I heard as I coaxed my dazed lungs into survival mode. A quick assessment revealed both of us to be sound, and I was somehow able to swiftly process the ridiculous sequence of events to begin laughing deeply until I noted an announcement from my legs that they had been plunged in the 55-degree water plenty long enough, and would I mind curbing my enthusiasm to get back in the boat? Reboarding the boat, Wayne's second time that day, We continued on, me helplessly giggling as I relived the improbable scene over and over. I was fully clothed, intending to change into swimwear when we arrived at the much more temperate Buffalo River site. The breezy ride was invigoratingly chilly, but I hardly noticed it, guffawing as I was at the succession of Lucy and Ethel, Jim Carrey, Inspector Clouseau events of the past few minutes. Things finally became calmer and less chaotic after this. We got one more surprise, but this one was welcome, a reward or consolation prize from above. As we lounged in the swimmer-friendly, bathtub balmy waters of the Buffalo River, we noted the abrupt presence of a stunning bald eagle swooping from the sky for a fishing expedition. We watched his graceful attempt and then marveled as he elegantly spiraled the thermals downriver. What serendipity. We did get our coveted bridge photo and enjoyed a memorable revisit of our second date without further channeling the Three Stooges. My sweet husband opined that it was good that the wacky hijinks of this nostalgia trip had not occurred during our initial acquainting boat ride 3 years earlier, as it most certainly could have been a relationship deal breaker. But I don't agree at all. I believe we would merely have been telling this story for 3 years longer. Only next time, I check the plug, the battery, the spare car key, the winch hook, the anchor, and our life insurance policies first.
Debbie Fowler is a member, observer, and amused chronicler of the most famous generation who lives in Conway. She met the love of her life at age 57 and is blessed to live an unforeseen adventure. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Faulkner County Library in Conway, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Changing the ocean, changing the sea. Take me back, baby. About to change me, everybody. Ought to change some time. Cause sooner or later, baby, you'll have to go down the lonesome ground. Now change my money, change my honey, change, baby, just to keep being fun, everybody. Now ought to change some time. Cause sooner or later, baby, have to go down lonesome ground. Now change my pants, change my shirt, change, baby, just to get shed of the dirt. Everybody ought to change some time. Cause sooner or later, baby, have to go down lonesome ground. Now change homes, change towns, change, baby, you know I'm always around. Everybody take some time. Sooner or later, baby, have to go down and lonesome ground. Now listen here, changing the ocean and changing deep blue sea. Now take me back, baby, find some change in me, everybody. Said, ought to change some time. Cause sooner or later, baby, have to go down that lonesome ground.
Thank you.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.